This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Good evening. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah. Welcome. It is indeed a blessing and honor to see you, your faces here in this space this evening. We're very excited and really excited and blessed to have with us a very special and gifted scholar and sister in this journey of life, Dr. Brenda J. Allen. Those of you who are part of the Whitworth community know that we take very seriously our enduring mission, and that is our promise to deliver to our students an education of the mind and heart that will equip you to honor God, follow Christ, and serve humanity. We also know that humanity, the very creation of God, is one that is extraordinarily diverse and beautiful. We also know that part of that diversity results from the social constructions that humankind has created. Many of the problems and challenges and yet opportunities that it presents each of us. This evening, we're going to be invited to consider the proposition that difference actually matters. And so I invite you to open up your minds and your hearts as we listen to Dr. Allen, but also as we reflect about our own journeys, as we tackle really difficult issues. How do we negotiate and navigate the differences that exist among the human family in ways that will lead us to an outcome of life, of health, of wholeness, of justice? Dr. Brenda J. Allen received her PhD at Howard University, and she serves as the Associate Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Inclusion, the Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Colorado, Denver. She is also a professor of communication, and she serves as master mentor of the tenure track faculty mentoring program at the university. Her research and teaching areas are organizational communication, diversity, group communication, and critical pedagogy. Among her numerous publications is a groundbreaking book entitled Difference Matters: Communicating Social Identity. That book will be on sale. It is on sale now, but it will be on sale at the conclusion of the lecture and question and answer period, and Dr. Allen will be available to sign copies of her book. In addition to performing her duties at the university, she presents keynote speeches and conducts workshops and consultations on a range of topics, including self-empowerment, diversity, leadership, inclusion, strategic planning, presentational speaking, mentoring, and teamwork. Dr. Allen has received numerous awards and accolades, including the Francine Merritt Award for Outstanding Contributions to the Lives of Women in Communication from the National Communication Association in 2004. In January 2006, she received the first annual award for outstanding achievement for commitment to diversity at the University of Colorado, Denver. She also was named a master teacher in 2008 by the Western States Communication Association. In 2011, Dr. Allen received the first annual award for excellence in faculty mentoring from the University of Colorado Denver and the Paul H. Bose Prize for scholarship from Ohio University for distinguished scholarship in the field of communication. She also was the Carol C. Arnold Distinguished Lecturer at the National Communication Association's annual convention. She received the 2013 Elizabeth D. Gee Memorial Award at the University from the University of Colorado System, which honors an outstanding faculty member for efforts to advance women in academia, interdisciplinary scholarly contributions, and distinguished teaching. Please welcome with me to Whitworth University into Spokane, Dr. Brenda J. Allen.
I really feel welcome. Thank you. Very nice. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Very good. Thank you so very much for that introduction. Thanks to you, Dr. Burnley, and to our provost for issuing the invitation for me to. This has been in the works for maybe a couple of years now, since you were inaugurated last year, is that right? So thank you so much for the invitation. I've just been here since around 2 o'clock today, and it's already been so richly rewarding for me in my own continuing journey when it comes to communicating difference matters. And that's what we're going to explore together this evening, the idea of the title, Communicating Difference Matters, which is set up intentionally with two meanings. Communicating difference matters. It's something that is significant. It's something we should think about. And there are many different matters in terms of communicating difference that we should be thinking about. So that's what you should be sharing with me this evening. By the time our talk and time is over, you should have much more clarity in terms of what are the matters in terms of communicating difference, as well as a deepened understanding of and commitment to communicating difference matters. Are you with me? I can't hear you. And so I start, as I often do, with a story. How many of you have had read the first chapter of my book? That was the assignment for everybody. Okay, so some of y'all. Well, in that chapter, I start with the story of being, I was recruited to the University of Colorado Boulder as a twofer. Does anyone know what a twofer is? Black female, okay? Or as I like to say, colored and curved, okay? So I was recruited to that campus because they were really trying to increase diversity, and at that point, diversity really meant women and people of color. So with me, they got a twofer. And they actually also recruited another black woman faculty member, and by hiring the two of us, they tripled the number of black women on the tenure track faculty. You don't need to be a math major, right, to figure out that means there was only one there before the two of us came in the tenure track. So at one point, not too long after I had been recruited, the summer before I was to teach a class in critical thinking, a student emailed me to say he was going to be in my class and would like to know more about what we were going to do, et cetera. So we exchanged some really pleasant emails. As the semester progressed, remember this is a critical thinking class, we were in the topic of assumptions, right? You know how assumptions operate? You usually don't even know you've assumed anything until what? Whatever you've been assuming, something else happens. You go, oh, wow, I assume, blah, 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 okay? So we were talking about assumptions, and let's say his name was Jason, because his name was Jason. Jason raises his hand and says, Dr. Allen, in terms of assumptions, remember how you and I exchanged those emails? I said, yes, Jason, because your name is Jason. He said, well, when I came to class and saw that you were black, I was shocked. Does that make me racist? Right? Because he assumed that I would not be black. In fact, he assumed I would be white. And I ask you that question. Does his assumption that I would be white or that I would not be black make him racist? Well, my response to him was, let's think about it. It's a critical thinking class. So I asked, how many of you have ever had a black person or a black female as a teacher anywhere in your educational experience, right? Very, very few, right? And in that class, zero. Ask me how many black female instructors or teachers I had in my life. Zero, okay? So, kind of makes sense not to expect. Then I said, how many black women or faculty do you think there are on this campus? You all know the answer, right? How many were there? Three, good, you're paying good attention. So, and then I said, because that was a while ago, and I said, have you ever seen black women depicted in the media anywhere as Professor Tice? At that point, no, and still very, very few, right? So I said, logically speaking then, it makes sense that you did not expect me to show up in that role. Therefore, your conclusion, your assumption does not make you racist. It makes you a person in a system that is racist because there are so few persons like me in these roles, right? That racism is a reason for that as well as sexism, but it doesn't make you racist. So I start with that story in my book, and I also start with that story with you this evening because it's located in an institution of higher education and because it's really capturing a lot of the points I want us to explore this evening in terms of communicating difference matters. So the very idea of he and I exchanging emails where there's no sense of identity other than our roles and our names, because upon reflection, I realized that I had assumed some things about him based on his name, Jason. What do you think I assumed? He was male. Based on that we were in Boulder, Colorado, what else do you think I assumed about Jason's identity? That he would be white, and he was, so I never pushed up against that. I also assumed he would be traditional college age because most of the students were then and still are. So we both were assuming, and we were assuming based on a system in which you're more likely to find certain kinds of people in certain kinds of positions and certain kinds of roles historically. And so communicating difference, we were able to talk about the issues in ways that we all could understand better some of the dynamics around difference in higher education at that time, that by our very embodiments mattered. And that moment was crucial to me changing my very area of scholarship from computer-mediated communication to looking at issues of social identity and power and organizational communication. And so that's what we're going to talk about this evening, communicating difference matters. And I want you to hold on to that story. Also, as I share some stories with you, I want you to get in touch with, do you have similar kinds of stories in terms of communicating difference matters? So what I'm going to do is talk with you a bit about that topic of communicating difference matters. I'm going to walk you through some of the kinds of things that I believe we should be especially mindful about in terms of communicating difference matters, and in particular focus on issues of communicating difference matters for Whitworth, because I've been very pleased in terms of what I've learned about this institution and its commitment to diversity, which is rooted in its very mission, which is to provide its diverse students an education of mind and heart, equipping its graduates to honor God, follow Christ, and serve humanity. So what I've learned is that in accord with this core mission, Whitworth seeks to model Christ's love across racial, ethnic, gender, socioeconomic, religious, and other expressions of human difference. So that notion of communicating difference matters is central to the mission of the institution itself and traces back to the very origins of the institution itself and is, like most institutions of higher education, having an opportunity to extend its scope and to provide an experience for students, for all students, to truly value those and other aspects of difference in social identity in ways unparalleled historically. However, that's not going to happen by itself. It has to happen with concerted effort by everyone who's involved. And I've, again, been very pleased to see the progress that Whitworth is making, and I'm confident and excited about the continued progress. So let's look at a little closer at this notion of communicating difference matters. Beginning with, what do I even mean by communicating? Communicating refers to ways that human beings try to share meaning with one another. How do we try to share meaning with one another? In my discipline of communication, we say you cannot not communicate. You agree with that? You cannot not communicate. If right now we just had a moment of silence, would some kind of communication still be going on? Sure it would. In terms of nonverbal cues, in terms of me standing here, beautiful flower. So that communication is constant, it's dynamic, it's ongoing, and it can be explicit or implicit. Very clear that someone is trying to share a certain message, or it may be embedded, or we may infer or perceive. And these issues in terms of communication always matter, regardless of who and who's trying to share what meaning, but they are especially crucial when we start talking about ways that human beings differ, because of different ways that people communicate, as well as different messages we've received about who to value, who to not value, who ought to be in what particular roles. Who can we expect to be where, as is the case of Jason and me. So implicit and explicit meaning is part of communicating, as well as communicating is verbal and nonverbal. So verbal, of course, refers to language and words and vocabulary, right? And even with verbal, it's important to think about how difference matters to language. The obvious in terms of what is one's primary language, you know, what did you learn, what language did you learn at home, as contrasted, what is the primary language of where you do other aspects of your life, even though you can share a meaning very clearly in that your original language, right, whatever that might be. But if that language is not also the one that's the dominant, then communicating difference matters in a different way for you. Moreover, you think about verbal communication, there's also your actual vocabulary and how well can you express yourself in whatever your language is. Then there are implications of thinking about language in terms of, for example, how many of you have heard of the word jargon? You know jargon, okay? What about slang, okay? What's the difference between jargon and slang? When you really think about it. Certainly you're close in terms of there's a distinct context, right, for each one. Someone else, that's really getting to it. Anyone else? Jargon? Yes. Yes. Jargon tends to have more positive connotation than slang, even though both mean a specialized system of ways to express oneself, right? That also tends to be implicated in terms of jargon being more professional context and slang being more urban, kind of, certain younger groups and so forth speaking a specialized language system. So right there you see how communicating difference matters. And there's value put on when everybody who's using jargon or slang is sharing meaning with one another in their particular group. So verbal and nonverbal. And nonverbal, oh my goodness. So first of all, nonverbal includes anything from how closely we stand to one another, eye contact, use of gestures. It also includes dress, right? That you're communicating something intentionally or not about who you are and how you're presenting yourself to the world. Moreover, what happens when nonverbal message contradicts the verbal message? Which message do you believe? The nonverbal. If I said to you, I have office hours on Monday afternoon, come by anytime. Would you feel welcomed? Probably not. Now, what if, for some reason, whatever one aspect of my culture, right, was that really was me being warm? What culture would that be? But anyway, just for the sake of example, right, that just about everyone in the room immediately got it, that nonverbal didn't go with the verbal, and that the nonverbal seemed much more like not welcoming. So my point is, communication is complex. So you have verbal and nonverbal, and actually it's amazing that we usually share as much meaning as we do when you start thinking about these distinctions. And also, as I've said, these issues are important no matter who's trying to share meaning, but especially if we're interacting across different social identity categories. Communicating is also formal and informal. We get socialized about even understanding when is it appropriate to use formal versus informal. And some insider groups know that better, right, than other groups, to the extent that if you don't know any better and you engage in informal communication for something that people say, well, that should have been formal. It's like, well, I didn't know that. You know, no one told me that, and it doesn't seem fair to assume that I would know. So there are distinctions and norms and expectations around communicating, period, in various settings that, again, some people are fluidly taught in ways that they probably can't even trace how they learned it, and that's called cultural capital, right? So they have access to ways of being in the world that some people assume everybody has or ought to have, right? If you're gonna be a blank in this organization, right, a member of this organization, a member of this group, then you should have known this. And part of what Inclusive Excellence talks about in terms of communicating difference matters is anticipating, as we're now having a wider variety of persons, of students, faculty, and staff aspiring to be part of higher education, is understanding some of these distinctions. In particular, understanding that these distinctions do not make any person superior or inferior. It's more about what you've been exposed to. So formal and informal, varying context. When you think about, it looks as if many of you are students, and students and also other guests here. Just think about today, from the time that you woke up until you're here this evening, and just thinking about the various kinds of organizations that influenced your life, that you had some kind of communication, whether explicit or implicit, relationship with, and there was some kind of communication. For example, any of you drive a car or ride in a car today? Raise your hands. So probably there were traffic lights, right? So some organization was controlling that and controlling your behavior, and that's a type of communication. Certainly you're here, many of you are possibly getting extra credit. So if you didn't get the extra credit, would you have come tonight? Don't answer that. But you know, the idea is that we communicate, we share meaning in a lot of different kinds of contexts. And every context has expectations about how you're supposed to engage and interact in those contexts. And some people have learned and been taught in ways that they can do that fluidly and aren't even necessarily aware that they shifted into, you know, I'm now in kind of professor mode, although I'm kind of like this most of the time, and all the people in my life are good. I'm also very humble. I know you've noticed that already. But we really are, we are doing the sharing meeting in so many different places and in so many different ways, the diverse media. My goodness, right? If you wanted to get a message to a friend, what are all of the ways you might do that, Ashton? Texting, Facebook, Twitter, email, face-to-face. Oh, yeah, actually going to see them, she said that's the last choice. Actually, face-to-face, imagine that. But the point is that we have various ways that we can share meaning. And again, all of those have expectations and norms and how-to. And all of these are, there are plenty of power dynamics. So I'll share those with you before I move on to my next point, which is thinking about difference itself. But power dynamics are crucial to all of these ways that we share meaning. And power very simply refers to ways that human beings influence one another. And frequently when we talk and think about power, we kind of assume, there we go with the notion of assuming again, we kind of assume that it's going to be one person has power over another, when in reality, power is always reciprocal. So if I'm the teacher and you're the student, who tends to have the most power, the teacher or the student? The teacher tends to, but you, if you're a student, you also have power. That's often shown in terms of ways we communicate. So when I used to teach undergrad, even if there wasn't a clock in the room, I didn't need a watch because I would get cues in terms of when time was up, right? In terms of their nonverbal behavior. I would get cues in terms of whether they were understanding me or not through nods or snores, right? I trust you see what I mean, that power is always reciprocal. And when it comes to, as I'm going to talk about now, in terms of difference in social identity, power matters greatly. And even the things I've talked about already, and some of you know this already, you know most of this, but perhaps it's not been framed in quite the way I'm sharing, so I hope you can relate already to the idea that, for example, looking at verbal and nonverbal, and thinking about cultural differences, in some cultures, looking you straight in the eye is a sign of disrespect. Whereas in Western culture, looking in the eye means that you're honest. So you can likely have a miscommunication in the sense of not trusting someone who has a different idea about that aspect of nonverbal communication. So those are some power dynamics. So when I talk about difference, so that's communicating, right? The first part of the title, sharing meaning, has lots of aspects to it. The next aspect of it is thinking about difference. And I prefer to talk about difference than diversity, because diversity really does matter, and diversity is a contested term that tends to refer, as it should, to thinking about members of underrepresented groups, especially in the United States, in terms of gender, race, class, age, sexuality, ability, status, religion, nationality. For each of those categories of identity, historically and currently, you will have persons who will tend to have more power just by virtue of being a member of that group, right? Just by virtue of that, than anything else. And so those power dynamics operate. Diversity efforts strive to be more inclusive, to level the playing field. There are a variety of ways we can think about and talk about that notion of diversity. I prefer to talk about difference as an invitation for us to think about ways that we all, as human beings, vary from one another in terms of the groups to which we belong or the groups with which we identify. So, and I also like difference because unlike diversity, which tends to be about you're strictly a member of one category or another, if I have difference on this side, what's on this side of the continuum? Difference here. Similar, same, right? When you think about other human beings and ways that we vary, do you think there's someone who's totally different from you on Earth? Not as a human being, right? Is there anyone totally similar? Not as a human being. Even if you have an identical twin, there's some differences, right? So I use that to invite us all to think about those aspects of identity, gender, race, class, age, ability, sexuality, nationality, religion, right? That we all probably can say we have a label, a category with which we would put ourselves, and we all, to varying degrees, are aware of how we are, quote, supposed to enact those roles. You agree? In terms of masculinity, for example. So we're all, I use this to mean scripted. We're all kind of taught this is how you enact a certain aspect of your identity, back to those norms and expectations. So difference is social identity, one's sense of oneself as being a member of a particular group. And so not only is it group oriented, but you have a sense that you belong, or someone else has a sense that you belong. This becomes fascinating, this notion of belonging, because of its relationship to the notion of communicating. So then you have in-group kind of stuff about, you know, as a blank, you're supposed to behave in this particular way. And if you don't, you may be subject to people talking about you or criticizing you. And if you do, you may be subject to people saying, okay, you, now you belong. Now you're acting like a whatever it is, right? So the membership can be perceived by others and or oneself. And a lot of these categories are very fascinating in terms of the kinds of cues, the nonverbal cues people look for. So when it comes to issues of, for example, racial or ethnic identity, so many persons are now rich combinations, right, of various groups that some of my friends and students say, people will say to them, what are you, right? As if they can't quite tell, they can't put them in that category, which even that communication, that sharing of meaning, when you think about it, it's kind of fascinating, right? So once I tell you what I am, then what, right? What's the utility of that information? Except, of course, sometimes it may be a genuine kind of way of small talk, of trying to get to know one another. So I'm not saying it as a negative, I'm just saying it as interesting when you think about ways we communicate different matters. In addition, that notion of social identity can be meaningful to oneself, and we have labels for these various aspects of identity. And I trust that you already knew this, and if you didn't, newsflash, we made all of them up, right? We made them all up, we as human beings, based on cues, right? So when a baby is born, we look for certain physiological cues or whatever, say, it's a boy, it's a girl. When some of you may know, there's lots of research and so forth now, especially also as that child begins to grow, she or he may have different ideas in terms of how she or he wants to identify in terms of gender. Similarly with race, wow. When I was born, on my birth certificate, where it says race, there was an N for, no, Nubian princess, soon to become a queen. For Negro, but we called ourselves colored in those days, right? And eventually, we started, in my generation, we started calling ourselves black. Why? Because James Brown, godfather of soul, said, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Which, if you don't know the history, is really fascinating because up to that time, calling each other black was something very bad and very negative. And in fact, in terms of communicating difference matters, we used to sing as little colored children. We used to sing, so when you're white, you're right. But if you're black, brown, stick around. But if you're black, ooh, baby. Get back. That's called internalized oppression in terms of communicating difference matters. And it relates to a concept called colorism, where the cues are your skin tone that puts you on a value system based on the group. So communicating difference matters, and we have labels that we use to identify ourselves in terms of these various categories. We learn them, we assign them to one another. And they all actually swirl all together. I would add nationality in terms of the ones that are especially significant in the United States and particularly relevant in institutions of higher education, where oftentimes when we say we're going to talk about diversity, we may really just mean we're going to talk about race, and that's not, there's nothing wrong with that, okay? And it's important to have clarity that there are times when you ought to foreground a particular aspect of identity. So don't hear me, don't mishear me, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is too often we neglect to consider that every one of us is a combination of these various labels, that depending on the context, one or two aspects are going to matter more than others. I once did an in-service for a group of high school teachers, and I'm actually going to have you do this exercise in a moment, when I asked them to think about which aspects of their identity especially matter to them at work. And one of the teachers said that being Jewish really mattered to her at work, not necessarily in a negative way, but that she was very aware of being Jewish because it was a highly Christian faculty and staff and the students and the families in that area, right? So she, it was just more meaningful and significant to her that a lot of the things that people talked about and expectations and assumptions were around a religious identity different than hers. And these are the kinds of challenges that some students may have as they enter spaces where there aren't as many people like them, as well as a lot of the norms and the expectations don't necessarily correspond with their lived reality. So difference matters in terms of the intersections of all these aspects of identity, and depending on the context, you may be more or less aware of your own aspects of identity as well as others' aspects of identity, depending on what's going on. So I want you to think about that idea, of difference matters for a moment, especially social identity. But first I want to be sure you really understand the concept. So social identity is one's sense of oneself based on being a member of a particular group. And we learn it, there are labels, they're assigned, and we look at each other and think we know which groups we belong to because of that. So if I said to you that I am a Broncos fan, would that be a social identity category based on that definition? Learned, identifiable, labeled, yes, right? Now, how would you know I was a Broncos fan when we go back to the definition of communicating with different ways we share meaning? How would you know I was a Broncos fan? I told you, very good. How else? Where I'm from? Right, I'm from Colorado, so it could be, right? What else? If I wore a jersey or clothing, right? If I came in and I, you know, if the Broncos won or lost, my affect might show that, okay? So there are different ways you can pick up cues, explicit, implicit, verbal, nonverbal, right? Remember, in communicating. So with that definition, again, of social identity, if I told you that I was shy, is that a social identity category? No, because that's personality, that's individual, right? That's not, it's a label, but it's not a label that's about that you know, I'm a member of all the shy group, you know, there's a shy group, and we get together and kind of avoid each other. I don't know. I'm sorry, shy people, that was very shyest of me. But you get my point, and I needed you to be sure you understand this, because I'm now gonna ask you, if I told you that I was going to introduce you to someone and all I would be able to take from you to take to them and tell them about who you are is you list three labels of social identity groups to which you belong. Get the assignment? So you have to say, this is who I am. I kind of like that. But I want, you get the assignment? And that's all they get. I'm not going to tell them your name. Why would I not tell your name? Right, because the name might give you cues. In fact, have you all heard of the resume studies? So resume studies in terms of, is someone more likely to hire Sarah or Lakeisha, right? Jamal or Jared? And it turns out these resumes were exactly the same, except for what they call a black-sounding name and a white-sounding name. Communicating difference matters. Similar studies with resumes with a female-sounding name and a male-sounding name. Who do you think got most callbacks? Male-sounding name. From persons who, if you ask them, most of them would not have been even aware that communicating difference mattered to them in that way. So I can't give them your name, just three labels to say, this is who I am. This label, that label, that label, each label a social identity. Not shy, not friendly, okay? Everybody have your three? Not yet? Make it happen. Three.
Thank you.
So, once you get your three, then I want you to go back to this idea that we communicate, or people think we're communicating. Back in the day, when I was in undergrad, I had a ginormous afro. Had my little granny glasses with the blue, sky blue shades, the bell-bottom tie-dye jeans, come on. And I would hear people saying, is that a boy or a girl? And it's sort of like, why does that matter, right? But they were confused in terms of how I may or may not have been performing identity. So the question is, for your three, would someone be able to infer any of those about you if they just now saw you in person? Or would it be something that you'd have to somehow tell them, right? So that's one question. The next question is, have you ever experienced someone giving you favor because of any of those three labels? And sometimes it's harder to even get in touch with that. Right? That's called privilege. Sometimes it's hard to even recognize privilege. It's sort of like saying to a fish, hey, fish, how's that water? And the fish is like, what's water? Right? And so it's not the fish's fault, but someone not a fish has to try to figure out water and splash around, etc. So have you ever experienced favor because of any of those aspects of identity? And have you ever felt discriminated against because of any of those three? Okay? If we had time, I'd actually have you discuss and share among one another. But my point is, communicating difference matters in ways that people sometimes haven't thought and felt about. But once I invite and ask you to just think about these relatively simple concepts, most people really get it, that it does matter. And that just thinking about gender performance, that most of us have been taught, and I like the idea of performance because it suggests that we are scripted, but we can choose to tear the scripts up or go off script or ad lib, right? Or improv if we want to. But we're all aware to a certain level of how we're supposed to perform and enact. So, you know, my skirt and blouse and earrings and rings and, you know, when you really think about it, what's up with all of that? Well, it does look kind of nice, but still, what's up with all of that? In terms of performing identities, right? So when you think about those aspects of identity, you think about yourself, and again, if we had time, we'd go a little deeper into it, but I have people talk about it with each other, and then I ask how it felt to reduce yourself to three categories. When in actuality, every single one of us in this room, given an opportunity, could list a list as long as I am tall, right? Volunteer, baby boomer, science fiction lover. Does that count? I think it could, right? If I go to those Star Trek. Why are you laughing? I love that stuff. But But you get my meaning that, and when we encounter people, even though people like to say they don't notice certain things, research shows that we are aware of primarily gender and race and sometimes age. And if we're not certain about sexuality, we may begin to guess about that. But typically, we kind of just assume along those lines. So my point is that we do communicate social identities in particular ways. I invite us all, as we encounter other people, to be aware of these issues in ways that maybe we haven't before. In particular, trying to be aware of times when we are doing what I call TUI, thinking under the influence of when you see someone kind of judging them in a particular way, or thinking that you know who they are, what kind of music they like, you think you know where they're from, how smart they are, I mean, on and on and on. All of this kind of operates in particular ways. And many times we're not necessarily on point. So that is, and I need to go back, that is the idea that's really crucial in terms of thinking about communicating difference matters. And yet there are many challenges. Well, I need to really go back, but I'll forget it. I can wing it for a minute. There are reasons that these notions of difference matter in our society. For one, and I'm sure you've heard demographics, right? When you think especially about race and ethnicity, there are, I think as of last year, there are more babies of color being born in the United States than white babies. So that says, you know, some years from now, especially in terms of thinking about college age students, that you're more likely to have, but you're not really because of other variables, unfortunately, in terms of kinds of education that members of certain groups still are having or not having. But at any rate, there are implications, right, in terms of that in a variety of ways. Also, in terms of persons with disabilities, that we are now, as opposed to when I was a little kid and when I was going to school, we're very much segregated kids with various disabilities from those who did not have disabilities. Now, mainstreaming and many of those students are coming to college. Many institutions have many more veteran students. And some of those students are coming from horrible experiences that when you look at them, you may not be able to see that they're dealing with struggles and levels of maturity and experiences that the person sitting next to them, they may both look very similar, but that difference really matters in their lives. You have many more persons in terms of sexuality and sexual identity coming out, if you want to say it in that way, having a sense of who they are and wanting to be valued, and yet that's a challenge in certain situations. All of these aspects of identity can be. So there are lots of demographics in addition to the one that's typically stated about race and ethnicity. Nationality. I didn't see a lot on your website, but I know some campuses have particular nationality groups. You have more of certain nationalities than others that begin to come to campus. Sometimes because campuses intentionally recruit them, sometimes because you may have a few students come and have a great experience, and then you have more come, so nationality matters. Immigration, certainly in Colorado, again, I'm not sure of what's going on here. I did not see anything, but perhaps it is. But students who are undocumented and yet very much deserve an education, I'm very pleased to say that we have some institutions in Colorado who are making a way for those students. So you get my point, is that more than ever before in higher education, there are lots of differences in terms of the kinds of students who want access. First generation students, right? The first in your family to go to college. For many of those students, the ways for students who are second, third, fourth generation who understand things like what is a syllabus, what are office hours, how do I register, how do you all have wait lists here? How do I wait list? For some students come from an experience where if you go to see the teacher, what? Because you're in trouble, right? It's not because you feel that, okay, I want to go talk to Professor so-and-so, or I even may say I want to go talk to Bob about, you know, my grade. that for some people that's very fluid and easy to do. For others, it's like unthinkable because of power dynamics and ways they've been socialized. So communicating difference matters in higher education. There are so many new issues, and some of these have been building for us to consider. Some institutions also are seeing an influx of people returning to school, right? So a lot of baby boomers like me, or persons who are having a need to have a new career, or maybe just a desire to have a new career. So higher education, in terms of these demographics, is a space where we're gonna more and more encounter one another across these beautiful differences. And what an opportunity it is. And yet, there are many challenges. So the challenges include a denial that difference matters. Sort of like, we're all the same, you know, don't talk about race, I'm part of the human race. And certainly that is true. And in an ideal world, none of these issues would matter. We'd meet each other as a human being and embrace and love that. But all of us are subject to these different schema and messages we've gotten about ourselves and members of other groups. So there's denial that these issues even matter at all. There's also false dichotomies, where we want to make something just an either or. So even in terms of race, in many instances, we're still reducing race to black or white. And even that neglects to think about the heterogeneity among white and the heterogeneity among black. I remember when I first moved from Youngstown, I went to undergrad in Cleveland, Ohio, and then I went to graduate school at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and that was a time when I hadn't been exposed to many other kinds of black people, and there wasn't a lot of other kinds of black people on TV or in the media, so the first time I saw somebody who looked like me, who had a Jamaican accent, I was like, wow, you know? So even it neglects the heterogeneity within groups and also neglects to think about the wide spectrum of racial identity. So we tend to have dichotomies. We also want to like simplify. So sometimes it's like we're just going to talk about this one aspect and make it very simple when all of these issues are very, very complex. And we tend, when we talk about these issues, to focus on the so-called other, right, the members of the non-dominant groups, neglecting again to consider that we are all raced, we are all gendered, right, and those aspects of identity always matter to all of us with varying consequences, right, a tendency for varying consequences, but still it matters for all of us. And we often frame difference or diversity as a problem, right? We need to solve this. And certainly we need to consider it, we need to focus on it, but I think taking that mindset of it's a problem or kind of negative already positions us, right, to be challenged in ways that are different than saying difference is exciting. Difference is an opportunity. So higher education matters because it's a primary source where we continue to construct our identities, where we can begin to learn more about who we are and what we can become, in terms of all those categories I mentioned and more. It also is a site where we actually encounter a rich tapestry and diversity of human beings, because the United States still tends to be extremely segregated in terms of where we live, where we go to school, where we worship, right? Even where we do entertainment and so forth, which to me is so, it makes me sad, because unlike other places I've heard about in the world where sometimes people are restricted from having access, right, to a variety of experiences and people and so forth, for the most part, we're not. We restrict ourselves. So here at this institution and other institutions is a place where we are more likely to encounter persons of a variety of backgrounds. Unfortunately, if we wait for our students, for the most part, a lot of students disrupt it, but for the most part, if we wait, like on my campus this year, our first year students are 53.5 plus something are diverse. So first I say to my colleagues, you mean students of color, right? Because that's what they're defined diversity. They say yes. And then I say, so what and now what, right? In terms of how are we making this a rich experience for all of our students? So not just those students of color, but for all students to really engage with one another and learn and grow and be prepared for this increasingly multicultural world. So it also then is a context for change, but that change is not going to happen by itself because of many challenges. One of which is we tend in higher education to talk about diversity by the numbers. So just like I said, the Denver Post last week, University of Colorado, 53% diversity. Okay? Right? That we focus so much on numbers that it almost feels like we're objectifying, right? We have so many of them. Even when we talk about demographics, there's going to be more of them, right? There are more brown people than ever before. So those numbers, right, as an approach, as opposed to, again, thinking about the rich opportunity and the implications. We also tend in higher education to be very much in our own silos, whether it is faculty affairs and academic affairs, student affairs and academic affairs, whether it is science versus music versus, right? So many silos in which we place ourselves that you also see these notions of difference play themselves out so that certain roles and certain aspects, you're going to see more persons who are members of particular social identity groups than others. You also, we tend to relegate diversity responsibilities to certain people. So typically, if there's, for instance, any kind of committee. So I dealt with this when I first was recruited as a twofer. Remember that? I was a twofer. Still am, I guess. I might be a threefer now because I'm also a silver fox. oh, crack myself up. So being a baby boomer, right, that aging category, but I get my senior citizen discounts. I'm like, somebody, are you a senior citizen? Yeah. Hook me up. But my point is that thinking about when I first went to CU Boulder, my chair was very wise. He was a white guy, and he said, they're going to want you to be on every D committee because they need a representative, right? And so I, unlike the two white women they hired in my department at the same time, I had many more expectations about service, about representing. When students, all kinds of students, by the way, not just students of color, when they found out the kind of person that I am, I'd have so many more students who wanted my time, and I gave them my time, right? It felt like that was part of my job. I also had groups pulling on me, women's groups, people of color groups, women of color groups, right, in ways that was very different because I was also expected to do everything else in terms of earning tenure. And I'm not saying this to say, poor me. I'm saying it to say these are ways that we communicate difference matters. We often don't stop and think about what we're doing and why we're doing it. So diversity tends to be for particular individuals or groups, only for certain units have the primary responsibility. And by the way, I'm not knocking that either. So for instance, on my campus, we have an Office of Disability Services, which is important for students and faculty and staff with disabilities. And however, the rest of us should also be aware of the services, be aware of ways we may or may not be seeming to be inclusive of persons with disabilities. So, do your syllabi have a statement on them about students with disabilities? Most campuses do, and oftentimes how syllabi communicate that comes across as, if you need help, right, we can accommodate you. Now, that's not intentional, but it's not a message that says something like, we want to ensure that everyone has a positive and affirming learning experience, right? But it really more feels like, and possibly because it has to in certain cases, and you can help me out with this, is that to be in compliance, right, So you do need to have it, and yet there's a way we might be able to communicate that in ways that then become important again, not just for those students with disabilities, but for other students to then consciously or implicitly, right, have a message in terms of how we value these aspects of identity. And certain disciplines and areas of study tend to be populated, and people are attracted by their gender, their race, their nationality more than others. Pretty predictable in most campuses. And we tend to polarize diversity and quality. One of the challenges with getting faculty in particular to diversify their curricula is this idea that that will compromise the quality of the education, as opposed to, and I can understand their concerns, even as I would invite a conversation about that in some examples, but there tends to be this sense of, if you have diversity, there goes the neighborhood, right, kind of attitude. And we also perpetuate lots of institutional isms. One of the biggest ones is classism that we rarely look at. So social class matters in ways that I'm fortunate, and also I worked hard to have been in a lot of different roles on my campuses where I've worked. And at one point I was a department chair. And I asked all of my faculty members to try to think about the selections they were making for textbooks, because some of them didn't even know how much the books they chose cost their students. Whereas, you know, you could have different choices and options. And I was that one who would tell students about alternative places than the bookstore. Don't tell, I guess, because I guess, you know, oftentimes that's part of the campus enterprise, but if the students get a better price, right? And I would ask faculty, put your at least one copy on overnight reserve, right? So just thinking about those kinds of things and expectations about kinds of events and activities for students to do, or even timing of things, whereas for some students, and I don't know enough about your overall kind of campus socioeconomic situation, and yet I'm confident that for some students, some of the kinds of assumptions that are made, it's much more of a challenge in terms of social class. So anyway, these are challenges that we face in higher ed, and we often tend to focus more on tolerance than truly thinking about social justice. And I guess you get it, that I would like for us to be more about thinking about social justice. So inclusive excellence is one way to approach all of these issues. It's comprehensive, based on research and theory, engages the whole campus community, thinks about students in terms of intellectual and social development, and creates a welcoming community, once again, for everybody. So certainly those who have been excluded, welcoming them, but also being thoughtful about who has tended to be part of the community, how can we make it such that everyone feels welcome? Really gets at some of the other issues I talked about. So diversity, quality, and inclusion all go together. And we think about that, and we think about how to help students learn, but how can the organization learn and grow and change, because this is 2014, soon to be 15, because it's October, can you believe it? So Whitworth is uniquely positioned in terms of inclusive excellence, in terms of communicating difference matters, by the very theological foundation, which is from Mark and says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind, with all your strength. The second is this. You say it with me? Love your neighbor as yourself. There's no commandment greater than these. So when we think about the various differences we've spoken to, and we think about the mission, we think about what Whitworth is striving to do, then one would assume and expect and be excited about, right, a welcoming community for everyone. And indeed, Whitworth is on the path to enacting, engaging the idea of inclusive excellence that we've spoken about, as stated in the strategic plan, which intends to cultivate an intellectually vital and inclusive campus culture. Doesn't that sound nice? intellectually vital and inclusive campus culture also seeks to prepare students to be global citizens. That's one of the other interesting and important things about difference in society, globalization. The world is shrinking, and expectations in terms of where we might travel, what we might do, global society. Moreover, we have Whitworth has a specific strategic goal to demonstrate courageous leadership in an increasingly diverse world. Again, just feel that for a moment. Courageous leadership in an increasingly diverse world. So that's not going to happen by itself, though. Even as I've had the privilege of meeting a few student leaders, as I do on all campuses where I go, students who are committed to these issues already, who are going above and beyond their curricular responsibilities to try to work on these issues, and yet those students alone aren't going to make the difference. It's going to take the concerted kind of effort that comes with promising practices, such as campuses having a visible and sustained commitment to the issues that I've spoken about, to an explicit connection to the mission. And again, the mission is very clear, right, in terms of what Whitworth is striving to do that connects to diversity, with diversity as everyone's responsibility. So yes, you have a chief diversity officer, she or he is leading, and everyone else also has responsibility. And not even thinking of it as like responsibility, thinking of it as responsibility, right? I get to have these experiences now that can enrich my life, that also preparing me as I go forth into the world. With diversity and inclusion strategic planning. Again, these things aren't just gonna happen on their own. You've got to strategize. You've got to think about what you're doing. You've got to have what will be an indicator that you've gotten there, right? Coming through your planning. Professional development, because I had a very interesting experience with one of the deans that I'm working with, well, I tried to work with, who, because of concerns that students from a particular nationality have expressed about how faculty members are responding to those students, then I invited the dean for a conversation about how I might assist faculty with adjusting to having students from different cultures who come with different understandings about how to learn and how to interact with faculty because they come from another country and another culture. So I said, I would be willing to work with your faculty. And the dean said, why would I have you work with my faculty? And so I decided to accept that as a real question. And I said, well, think about like how we want faculty to use more technology in their teaching. We can't assume that they know what the technologies are, how to select them. So I have pedagogical practices. I have ways that you can reach students who come from different countries, right, of understanding their cultural differences. He still wasn't buying that. He said, I don't think that you can come and tell my faculty how to teach. So I said, thank you very much. Seems that you're not ready for my assistance. And I dropped the mic and I was out, right? and by the way, he and I our paths will cross again. And I hope they will cross because he will have thought it through a bit more. He will see the kind of work that I'm doing. So I am so not having negative feelings. I can understand his sense of wanting to protect faculty in particular ways. I can understand his reticence. This kind of resistance is not unusual from people in all categories of groups on campuses because of fear, because of the sense of this is my territory, this is my turf. I know how, right? It's that kind of me, me, me. That because many people aren't aware of the kinds of issues I've shared with you this evening and about why communicating difference matters. So I'm patient and I try to be loving and respectful. And, you know, unfortunately, the other challenge is he may have to come back to me because if enough student complaints come in, then he's going to have to, you know, it's going to be more of a sanctioning kind of thing. Hope it doesn't get to that. So my point, though, is professional development initiatives, there are many persons who can come and help faculty, students, and staff understand these notions of communicating difference matters in very positive and affirming ways, rather than assuming that people can just figure it out on their own. Assessment, figuring out how are things working out, and rewards and accountability. So one of the big things, especially for faculty of color in predominantly white institutions, I alluded to the kind of additional work and expectations. Some of us call it a cultural tax that we have to pay, especially because many of us, like me, I want to help. I want to do that kind of work, even though I have all these other responsibilities. So, but not necessarily rewarded. I remember very clearly that I think it was my first year, the Black Student Alliance gave me an award for best faculty member. And sort of like, well, there wasn't that much to choose from. No. because a white faculty member could have won that too. And so that's not out of the question, seriously speaking. And yet, one of the other black women came up to me. She said, that's not going to count for anything when it comes to tenure. And I said, okay, but this was important for me to work with these students, right? Even though, right, it is a challenge. And so the notion of rewards and accountability is very, very important. And thinking about recruitment techniques that really work. So most campuses still, just like way back then at CU Boulder, when they recruited me as a twofer, many campuses are still trying to recruit faculty of color, they say. But there are some techniques that are going to be more effective than others. And in fact, guess how CU Boulder found me? They literally found me with somebody knew somebody who said, and I was at Howard University, and they said, if you have somebody there that you think might want to come teach here, we would be very interested. So the person who reached out to me is someone I respected and liked. And honestly, I was not thinking about moving anywhere. But she said, well, call Dr. Phil Tompkins, and if you know communication at all, he's retired now, but he was a big, big name in the field. I was like, call Phil Tompkins? So I called him, and we connected immediately. I went for an interview. Next thing you know, it's like I'm eligible to retire now that I made a wonderful living there because they found me. So there are recruitment techniques that actually can work. So these are different ways of promising practices. So as I wind down, there are some obvious next steps for the institution to take that the institution is already taking that include develop and seek to enact a vision. And by the way, even us as individuals should have some kind of vision of the world and our lives, and then anything you do, you ask yourself, is this in service of the vision I have for myself and my life? Or is this something that's going to take me somewhere else? And sometimes it may take you somewhere else, and that's okay, but you ought to be conscientiously making those kinds of choices. So that's just a quick aside on the individual tip. But institution and really enact inclusive excellence is a tried and true approach. Try to get something that's sustainable. I had a conversation with a group earlier today where we talked about any kind of initiatives, and diversity is just one of them. Inclusive excellence is just one. Sometimes you have a leader for whom these issues really matter. So let's take technology as a different example, where someone may have that as a vision for, or interdisciplinarity. That's one that gets a lot of attention. So that leader may say, we want more interdisciplinary programs and make it happen. When that leader moves on, the next leader comes in, interdisciplinarity is gone. So it's important if you have leaders who care about these issues that you get things in place that are sustainable and not just a one-time deal. And everybody should be involved. Every one of you in this room, I encourage you to think about how well do you think, especially students, how well do you think this institution is preparing you for this increasingly multicultural world through the things they are offering you as opposed to what you have to seek for yourself, even though I encourage you to seek them for yourself. Never, ever wait for somebody else, right? Even as you should feel entitled and that you're owed because you are students here. And I'm not saying this for you to like rebel and so forth, but just to be thoughtful about that power dynamic that oftentimes it's just, well, I'm just a student, I'm just going to do my time and move on, right? Of thinking about that, everybody, and communicate difference matters. Back to the topic of communicate difference matters. And look for ways that difference matters in positive ways and share with one another. If you have other ideas, I encourage you to consider them as I move into what you might do as an individual for this topic of communicating difference matters. But before I put up some of my ideas, I want to hear from you. Who has an idea of what you can do or continue to do as an individual, whether you're student, faculty, or staff, in terms of any of the issues I've shared with you of communicating difference matters, or community member, whoever you might be, for whatever reason you were drawn here this evening, right? What can you now do as an individual? Yes, Ashton. Take track. What is it? Very good. So think about what you're thinking about. This is nice. It's almost like, you know, we choreographed that. Take stock of assumptions you're making when you meet other people. So it goes right back to that opening story of Jason and me, right? In terms of the assumptions we both had, mine were met, so I didn't even realize I had made them. And yet, I could have also stopped to think, which I did much more than many of my colleagues, and most of my colleagues were white, and even my white colleagues talked about how white it was at Boulder, right? But they also homogenized those students, right? As if all those students were alike, when there was already diversity in the room with all white students, right? And so taking stock of any kind of assumptions you are making and not be afraid of it. Don't be afraid if you realize that you've done some kind of ism. I was in Florida about 4 years ago, and I was at a conference, and I was at the beach. They had a conference session on the beach. Yeah, right. Anyway, I was on the beach, and there was one of those. You've seen those newspaper boxes, right, on the street? And so the front page had all these little pictures of what looked to be Latinos. And my mind said, I wonder what they did. I wonder if they are Johns, men who had solicited prostitutes. Some cities you may know, they actually published pictures of Johns. I wonder if they are illegal aliens. I wonder if they are deadbeat dads, right? When in actuality, does anyone remember what happened in 2010 with Latino men, Latinos? They were the Chilean miners, 33 of them. And the irony of it was, as a person who teaches diversity, who teaches we need to realize distinctions among groups, we need to value, et cetera, my mind, I was TUI, thinking under the influence of dominant notions of brown and black men in the media. Now, it's back to that question I asked, Jason asked me. Does that make me racist? Nope. It makes me a product of how I've been socialized that actually has been scientifically proven in terms of analyzing the media and how it depicts certain people, especially being on the front page, right? So I also am guilty of that, but I don't feel badly or ashamed. Momentarily, I'm like, dang, really, Brenda J? You know, because again, I'm following the story. I'm on, you know, Dr. Diversity and helping other people, and yet that's where my brain went, right? And my brain went there also because of the medium of the newspaper, because there were little teeny pictures which kind of looked like mug shots. I'm not saying this to excuse myself, but I'm saying it, I hope, to deeply put this impression on you that we do take cues and we do make assumptions, and we then often act on those without even realizing that we've done so. So you see, I really like your idea. Thank you. Anybody else? What will you do differently or better? I agree with the basic idea of taking more agency as a member of an underrepresented group. Even as I caution you to be careful, because sometimes other people will expect you to do that work for them. So thinking of it as a dialogue and mutual, I do totally agree. And also for members of the dominant group, if you hear my narrative, for instance, as a black female, for you not to think I am representing all black females. I'm sharing with you one experience, and you're right that I hope that can then open it up to realizing, wow, there's so much more to a person than I see. So yes, I think that the idea is a really important one. What else? And by the way, especially for persons who, it's for anyone, members of underrepresented groups, but for persons for whom those identities aren't obvious, right? For those invisible aspects of identity, to welcome an opportunity to help, again, disrupt people's senses of identity. So one of the persons who works with me is Mexican-American, but he looks very, 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 very white. In fact, some of his wonderful colleagues of color tease him about that. And so he helps people, he disrupts that notion of what Latino identity is and talks about his experiences of his family coming from Mexico and so forth in ways, again, that kind of challenge the stereotypes and expectations people have. Okay, so I want one more. Who is it going to be to share? What are you going to do differently or better? Hi. Yes, really, really good. Of recognizing your own privilege and not feeling ashamed of it, but rather understanding that your privilege is a place where you can enact power, be an ally, speak up and speak out, right? Invite additional ideas and stories and narratives in particular ways. Help people who are maybe part of your identity group to understand things differently. So for me, now that I'm middle class, I really get the level of privilege that that brings me. And I try to be aware of that distinction for me and some other persons in my life. So those are three really, really good ideas. Here are a few more. Is strengthen your own personal commitment to communicating difference matters. Because one at a time, we already can and have been making a difference, especially when you think about love thy neighbor as thyself. Just that very premise, if you lived your life really like that, or at least you tried to, this won't always be easy. And if you look upon every person as, quote, thy neighbor, as thyself. Work within your own spheres of influence, right? Who are your friends and family and classmates and faculty members and teachers and staff members with whom you work? What can you say to them? How can you ask for additional services? Or how can you volunteer and say, I'd like to do this, that, or the other? So everybody already is empowered, but it's up to you. Proactively apply anything you have learned or are learning. Good news is that most institutions like this have lots of opportunities to learn more about the issues we've shared this evening. Whether it's through a class, whether it's through guest lectures like this, whether it's through film, through any number of experiences, service learning, volunteering, etc. So really learn more and then be sure you're living the lessons that you have learned. So, whoops, really gotta show this last slide. As I close, I want to come back to the primary idea of communicating difference matters and back to asking you, actually, for you to reflect. You don't have to answer unless you want to, and it's a positive answer, by the way. I ask you to think about whether or not you believe that communicating difference matters. And I promised you that we would think and talk and explore what are the matters and how do they matter. And I invite you to just take a moment to reflect on that as you leave this place and go forward for the rest of your life. And certainly for those of you who are students and then faculty and staff and community members in terms of Whitworth, that this is also the statement in Whitworth's commitment to diversity for the expectations for the strategic plan 2021. Grounded in a biblical understanding of God's character, the university will cultivate in students, faculty, staff, and trustees the capacity to relate effectively across multiple dimensions of human diversity in learning, working, and living environments. To accomplish that extremely powerful goal, Whitworth is going to really have to embrace communicating difference matters.